This edition of Midori House was first broadcast on the 30th of May, 2016, on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. Coming up on today's show, hundreds more migrants drown attempting the Mediterranean crossing. Is there actually anything that can be done to dissuade or prevent others from taking the same risk? My guests Oscar Guardiola Rivera and John Everard will be here to discuss that and the day's other big stories, including strike season begins in France. Is this a genuine struggle for the 35-hour week or a somewhat theatrical showdown between the government and the unions? Should the Rio Olympics be held elsewhere? And is there actually a chance that, despite everything, Latinos might turn out for Trump? That's all coming up on Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Oscar Guardiola Rivera, Senior Lecturer in Law at Birkbeck University here in London, and John Everard, former British Ambassador to North Korea, among other postings. Welcome both. First of all, last year, according to the best estimates of the International Organization for Migration, 3,771 migrants and refugees drowned attempting to cross the Mediterranean Sea. The year before that, the figure was 3,279. Now, with all due acknowledgement that those numbers are likely to be underestimates, 2016 appears poised to be worse still. More than 700 feared lost in three incidents last week alone. John, first of all, they are still coming then. 46,000 have arrived in Italy alone so far this year. 13,000 fished out of the sea last week. Any number of measures and ideas have been floated or taken to stop them. Why haven't they stopped them?
Because they're all coming through Libya. I mean, the Balkan route hasn't been entirely blocked, but the flow that way has been heavily slowed. They didn't come before because we had a tough dictator in Libya. And now that he's gone, let's open the door and they'll all come through. And the answer, long-term, is going to be to restore stability to Libya, which, when we talk about a long-term solution, we mean long-term. It's going to take a very long time to put that country back together. And in the meantime, they're going to keep coming and coming, and nobody has any idea what to do about it, and I'm afraid I don't either.
Oscar, as John was pointing out, the Balkan overland route does seem to have largely been stifled by various measures, whether they're fences along the borders or deals between the EU and Italy. Does this illustrate then that the problem can't actually be solved? It can only be moved around?
I think so. I was in Greece some 3 weeks ago, and what I saw there in the camps was a sort of reflection of that, shuffling around the problem. You saw Greek officials telling you that they feel there is no solidarity whatsoever from Northern Europe. And when you talk to Northern Europeans, they say that there can be no silver bullet solution. So in a sense, everybody just keep moving the problem around, when in fact, what we must do is to have clear conversation about the long-term plan, because this is going to continue.
I mean, long-term plan has to be that these people stop arriving in Europe at all, Greece or anywhere else. We have to remember, for a long time, we corked the bottle. I mean, there always has been immense pressure to migrate to the relative freedoms and, more particularly, the relative wealth of Europe. But the politics of North Africa and the Middle East prevented that from happening. If we get a political fix in Libya, then the cork goes back in the bottle. It's important to remember, too, that we keep talking as if these people are all Syrians being driven there by war. There's a lot else going on right now. I mean, a lot of these refugees are being driven by poverty rather than repression. And the drought in Somalia, which is absolutely atrocious and which has hardly been reported on in the Western media, is, in my view, at least as strong a driver as the civil war in Syria.
Well, that's precisely the point. I mean, it's not just about pulling the plug in Libya. As you pointed out, there are other issues, and poverty is a major issue that is not going to be solved anytime soon.
No, we're not going. You're right. We're not going to solve anytime soon the drive to get to Europe. What we can do over the longer term is physically prevent people from crossing.
John, and I'll put this question to both of you. John, first of all, how far are we from the point, though? And I would submit that the presidential election result in Austria suggests not very far, from which the political leadership of a European country which might have the best, noblest, most humanitarian instincts in the world is nonetheless going to have to make a choice between taking a hard line on migration, possibly an unpleasantly or draconianly, if that's even a word, hard line, a choice between doing that and basically handing their country over to the far right?
Well, yes. I mean, I think we are quite close to that point in many European countries. Austria is one you mentioned. Hungary isn't far behind. Slovakia. We've seen a rise of anti-immigrant far-right parties in France, of course, and in Germany. It's all simmering away just below the surface. One thing that saddens me through this whole debate is to watch the shift in public opinion. When this episode started, there was a kind of division of opinion between people who felt these are human beings like us, you know, they deserve our sympathy, we should give them shelter. They have steadily lost ground to people who say, no, this is our country, we are not going to let it be flooded with refugees, and we will do whatever it takes to keep these people out. And the rise of the far right, I think, is just one reflection of that.
I mean, Oscar, I guess the same question in a different way. Is it preferable that a centrist or liberal government does the thing that may seem counterintuitive, even distasteful to it, and takes the hard line, than the far right getting elected and doing it for real?
But also the counterintuitive thing here is to remember that if public opinion was swaying towards finding a more progressive solution at the beginning of this crisis, that can happen again. So we should not concede the argument totally. There can be a government, a centrist, progressive, liberal government, which, showing the proper leadership, does persuade the people that there is another solution that is not just this draconian solution that is not going to work anyway.
I mean, yes, in theory, sure, that is possible. It's just that in the present circumstance of Europe, I see no prospect whatever of any such government arising. The movement is entirely the other way.
Again, but that's precisely the sort of chicken and egg question. Is it the case that we're having this swing towards the right wing precisely because of the lack of leadership, more progressive leadership from our current leaders, or is it the other way around? I would still hope, and I still want to think, that it is precisely because of the lack of more progressive leadership that people are swaying in that way now, because we have seen how they, the people themselves can be more progressive before.
Look at Germany. I mean, Angela Merkel goes out on a limb, gives very clear leadership, says this is a humanitarian issue, Germany must be generous. That didn't stop the rise of Alternative für Deutschland, for the far right. Look at Austria. The government accepts that Austria has a moral obligation to take in refugees. What happens? You get an election where 49.9% of Austrians vote for the far right. Despite strong leadership in the direction you've indicated, we are still getting this very sharp backlash.
That's very true, but I could also give the example of a Spain, which would be a counterexample to what you're saying. Or even this country, the UK, you have a lot of people here who are, showing signs of looking for a more progressive solution to this problem.
Yes, in the UK, we had the backlash before the reaction, didn't we? I mean, we had UKIP, with all it stands for, making very clear that immigration should stop long before the present crisis erupted. So I think in that case, the government's been reactive. Can I just, before we leave the subject, make one final point? That the kind of migration that we are seeing is destructive for everybody. I understand entirely the urge to provide shelter and asylum for people whose country has fallen into civil war, like the Syrians. Most of the people arriving now, as I say, are not Syrians. They are fleeing poverty rather than war. And these are the people who have the money to pay the human traffickers. If you have that money, you're almost certainly far better spending it in your country to alleviate your situation there than gambling on this very dangerous crossing to Europe and trying to make it big in Europe. You end up with
question, the question then becomes what European governments can do to precisely allow for that gamble to be taken in the country of origin.
Well, yes. I mean, we could spend all day talking about this, but clearly you very quickly get on to questions relative to development of what's going on in those countries. The presenter says stop. I'll stop.
I was just going to say, we do have other subjects to address, and as John points out, that one could run and run, and rather depressingly, I suspect, rather will this summer. We should look now at France, and few people who have visited it more than once will be unfamiliar with the feeling of having flights cancelled by disgruntled baggage handlers, ferries becalmed by indignant dock workers, trains delayed by malcontents burning tyres on the tracks and brandishing the Scarlet Standard. Even by those standards, however, the strikes presently besetting France are spectacular, causing shortages of fuel and increasingly of tear gas as police respond to characteristically spirited demonstrations. Oscar, first of all, at the heart of this is some workplace proposals being, well, not proposed, rather rammed through by the government. What's actually wrong, as the demonstrators see it, with what the French government is suggesting?
Well, to begin with, as you yourself suggested, that style of government and governance in which you ram out of the throats of people a proposal that lacks enough support. Again, it is very difficult to say that you are in a democracy while at the same time you are very ready to just dismiss the will of the people as either ignorant or nonsensical.
This is, of course, the quirk in the French Constitution, Article 49.3, which allows a government basically to bang things through without the trouble of having to consult the National Assembly.
That is true. But of course, this is when we can invoke Rousseau's general will. It's very difficult for representative agencies of government to act without the support of people, and we're beginning to hear even comparisons with 1968, which is kind of surprising, but in a sense not entirely inaccurate.
John, to what extent is this an actual thing? To what extent is it merely the traditional flexing of muscle by trade unions before a huge internationally scrutinized sporting tournament? And to what extent is this? I mean, it's spring. This happens in France. You haven't really been to Paris unless you've been tear gassed at least once.
Well, that's right. It's spring, as you say, and the sap rises through trade unionist veins. But there's more at stake here. I agree with Oscar that the presentation, the way that the law has been handled, leaves quite a lot to be desired. The substance of the law is actually modest, going on timid. And it's important to remember, has the support of the moderate trade unions. The people who are organising the strike, the CGT, are the far left, the hard ones, who appear to be frightened not so much that the law will come through, as that if it goes through, then they cease to be the preeminent trade union in France. The centrist trade unions take over. And they also know that they have a bomb ticking, that we have elections in France next year, and unless the polls are wildly wrong, the centre-right is going to win them. And all the centre-right candidates have got lined up quite a raft of what the CGT insists are destructive neoliberal policies. They're out on the limb a bit. How effective has this strike been? I mean, it's been spectacular, certainly. But you're starting to get now the sense that the momentum is drifting. The petrol pumps are reopening. Most of them reopened today. They are still in conversation over the big transport strikes, the aircraft and the trains that are supposed to start in a few days. There seems to be a reasonable chance they'll be called off. If that happens, then the CGT, politically, are in deep trouble.
I mean, Oscar, is this, and it's quite, I think, quite often a dynamic of large-scale strike actions when trade unions take on the government. Is this both sides banking on the idea that the public will blame the other for whatever trouble this causes?
Well, in a sense, that is part of the tactic and a strategy of a strike. And it is the case that a strike is a cyclical thing. So there is a moment in which the longer it gets, the more it risks losing momentum. Having said that, as you pointed out also, John, the stakes are higher here, because this is not just about what is happening now, but also a calculation of what is likely to happen in the future. And that means the unions, both the more moderate and the less moderate ones, are trying to send a message to possible leaderships in the future. At least in this case, the message is that they're not ready to just open the door ajar for, you know, a little bit, so because they know that once they do that, you know, everything else will come down.
Absolutely. As the Prime Minister Valls himself has said, what is in play here is the very concept of reform. Does France reform or doesn't it? I mean, you can talk about the details, the pace and the scope of reform later. And of course, as I said, feeds through into the elections next year. The moderate trade unions, we have to remember, have supported these reforms. It's only the CGT that are out on strike. But yes, there are big conceptual elements here.
I mean, John, just a final thought on this. Is part of this down to the fact that François Hollande has reached that very weird stage in an elected politician's career where he is so terrifically unpopular, and he's polling worse than Louis XVI, that he just thinks that it doesn't matter. I might as well try this stuff on, whether it's because I believe in it or whether it's because it might actually rescue me.
I think there's bits of that. I think there are also bits of legacy. Hollande wants to be remembered for achieving something, and so far his rule hasn't really delivered very much at all, has it? If he can get this through, then at least, you know, la loi Hollande goes somewhere.
Well, we're going to take a short break now. You are listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, along with John Everard and Oscar Guardiola Rivera. Coming up next, should the 2016 Rio de Janeiro Olympics be the 2016 Somewhere with Fewer Mosquitoes Olympics?
How do you write a biography? Are we all curators today? Who still makes fanzines? And how close are fact and fiction? These are some of the questions constantly puzzling us here at Monocle. So each week on our culture show, we spin the globe to find the very best writers, musicians, artists, gallerists, filmmakers, commentators, and even mudlarks to debunk these cultural mysteries. Tune in to Culture with me, Robert Bound, every Monday at 1900 UK time, where all will be revealed.
The Ocean Fresh June issue of Monocle heads to sea for an outing that unpacks everything from security tussles in the Pacific to what boat you should be rowing across to your lakeside retreat. Here's what our captains have planned for you this time.
In the design section, we make for the Venetian Lagoon and Murano to meet the people breathing new life into the island's ancient glass industry. We take a look at the curious architectural gems built during London's naval heyday, and we take a trip across the Bosphorus to discover a sea-facing villa built by one of Turkey's most celebrated modernists.
In the edit section, we reel in a haul of seaside-themed take-homes and tuck into a steak with the famous graphic designer Bob Gill in New York for his imagined last meal on Earth. Plus, some fresh reporting from Madrid's state-of-the-art fish market and a neighbourhood on the up in Adelaide. We also show our favourite new hotel finds from Santiago to Barcelona and food from San Francisco to Stockholm.
Monocle's June issue is on newsstands now, or guarantee your copy by joining us as a Monocle subscriber. Visit monocle.com to find out how.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Oscar Guardiola Rivera and John Everard. Now, it is 67 days until some or other as yet unarrested Brazilian politician declares the games of the 31st Olympiad open at Rio's Maracana Stadium. 100 or so leading boffins, however, have written to the World Health Organization to outline their view that this is a bad idea. Given the risk posed by the mosquito-borne Zika virus, they say it would be unethical, no less, for the games to go ahead. They believe the games should be postponed or relocated. Oscar, do they have a point?
I was in Rio a month ago.
And lived
to tell the tale. No mosquitoes around, and cariocas would tell me that what you need to do is to drink as many caipirinhas as you can. You will either...
Isn't that kind of their answer to everything?
Yeah, that's the answer to everything, and particularly, but they're more concerned, cariocas are more concerned about what you pointed out. Who's going to open the Olympics? It's very possible that everybody will be in jail by then.
It might be you.
That would be nice.
Have you started to wonder where you fit on the kind of on the order of succession yet?
I'm probably up there with the Zika mosquito.
John, is there any kind of argument? Well, let's stand it on, look at it from the other way. If there is a public health risk, is there an argument for not moving or postponing the games. As they point out, precedents exist. The 2003 Women's World Cup was moved due to the SARS virus, and so was the 2015 African Cup of Nations was relocated due to Ebola.
Yes, there are precedents, you say, but even so, to be honest, there's not much of a case. I mean, if you were worried about health epidemics in Brazil, Zika, of fashionable, new, exciting, with the mosquitoes bzzz, everywhere, but it's not the big problem in Brazil. I mean, you've got dengue, you've got malaria, but no one's talking about those. Secondly, the games are going to take place in 6-7 days, you said, August, when deep winter, mosquitoes don't go around biting in winter. They've got their woolly coats on, they're far too sort of busy shivering in the aisles, whatever they do. Thirdly, the total amount of travel involved in these games is absolutely tiny in world terms. It's 0.25% of total world travel predicted for 2016. If you were serious about stopping the spread of Zika, and you believe that you needed to stop people moving in and out of Brazil to do that, you would need to close down all travel in and out of Brazil, which nobody, as far as I know, is suggesting.
All travel in and out of South and Central America. Zika is not that weirdly localised. Yeah. I mean, Oscar, the boffins, I just like saying boffins, are saying that their concern is that people who come to the game, specifically, not really the tourists, most of whom will arrive from developed countries with, you know, functioning healthcare infrastructure, but they're worried about athletes specifically from developing countries who may go back to them with the Zika virus and spread the virus to places where the health system cannot cope with it. Is that a legitimate concern?
One can understand the concern. In some respects, it is legitimate. But as John was saying, if you were serious about it, you would have to acknowledge that the Zika virus has now spread pretty much to every country in Northern South America, the Caribbean, and Central America, which means that actually it is very unlikely that you would have that particular case of a person, you know, stopping all possibilities of the virus, you know, being spread. I don't think that the boffins are being here too boffinesque. If such a word exists.
We ought to point out that we've got boffins and counter-boffins around now. I mean, the 150, wasn't it, who signed the letter? Okay. But lots of other high-level boffins have come out and said, rubbish. You know, the World Health Organization is entirely right.
The CDC
is not buying it.
No, that's right.
I mean, from a diplomatic point of view, John, just a final thought on this one. How could or should the Brazilian government handle this, I guess, from a purely public relations point of view? Should they just say, look, it's bad, but really worse things happen at sea.
First, they have to find someone. Well, first they would like to.
You shunt it onto the competent authority. You say, we take the Zika threat very seriously. The safety and security of all visitors to Brazil is topmost in our minds, and we will do whatever the World Health Organization tells us to do, knowing full well that the World Health Organization has already said, don't worry about it.
Also, by the way, the train to Vara, where the games are going to take place, is not finished and will not be finished. So it's very likely that a lot of people who would go to the games would not go at all. So they'll remain in the beaches.
Yeah. Well, finally tonight, one might have assumed that the easiest task facing Hillary Clinton's campaign team in the run-up to the presidential election in November would be the one of corralling the ballots of Latino voters. One might have assumed that all that would be necessary would be constant repeats of Donald Trump's plentiful, ignorant, hateful, and plain idiotic statements on the subject of illegal immigration, foreigners in general, and Mexico in particular. One might be wrong. Hispanic groups have told the Democrats that pointing out Trump's manifold deficiencies in this realm may not be enough. Oscar, speaking on behalf of every single Latino person on Earth, an intriguing statistic. Trump is polling at 77% unfavorable with Latinos, which it seems reasonable. 12% favorable. Who are the 12%?
Probably Episcopalians, and there are quite a few of them. No, that's probably a bad joke. Actually, it's not that unsurprising. In a sense, for many people, and some Latinos included, Trump is the very incarnation of the do-it-yourself American dream.
The up-by-the-bootstraps
exactly.
types, starting with a loan of a mere couple of million dollars from his father.
Exactly. Well, people tend to forget about the real deal. Details of the story when it comes to the myth, but that myth works, and that is important. It's important to take that into account. Also, most important of all, the U.S. elections are not being decided and will not be decided on ethnic lines. The problem here is a deep malcontent with economics and the political class, and that is impacting all sectors of the population in very different ways. So On the one hand, you have the anti-establishment Trump. On the other hand, you have the anti-establishment Bernie Sanders doing very well among Latinos in California.
I mean, John, is this something, if you look at this from Trump's point of view, is it something even worth pursuing? I mean, what happens if he names as his running mate, say, Rubio or Cruz or Susana Martinez?
I don't suppose we're going to find out anytime soon, to be honest. I doubt if even that would swing the Latino vote.
Yeah, certainly not.
The noises coming out of the Latino community in the United States are pretty emphatic, and we have to remember that last time round they voted solidly Democrat. I read this whole episode as more than anything a plea to both sides, please to talk substance, not just to slag each other off. They're saying to Hillary Clinton, in effect, it is not enough for us to vote for you that you are not Trump. We want to hear what you'll do for us in terms of education, healthcare, you know, how our kids grow up, and things that actually matter in our lives. And so far, in fairness to them, they've heard nothing.
John is absolutely right. There has been a conspicuous lack of content and substance in this election. And
I'm getting the impression that holding your breath waiting for it would be a bad idea.
I think so. I think we won't hear more of that. But at the very least, the lobbying groups, you know, the La Raza Council, in the case of Latinos in the U.S., are making it very clear that they need to hear some policy proposals.
I mean, Oscar, what have you made of Trump's outreach to the Latino population so far, which, as I've understood it, has mostly consisted of him tweeting a picture of himself eating a taco bowl with the caption, "I love Hispanics."
Actually, I was in Florida when he was there, and it was very interesting to ask different sectors of Latinos. If you were to ask middle upper class Venezuelans or Colombians, they don't fear Trump, and in a sense, they like him. But if you ask others, Hondurans and so on, they're more afraid of it. I mean, let us remember, Latinos are not a monolithic group. They're very different, and, you know, the variations. Trump knows that when he slashes and goes against Mexicans, other groups of Latinos do not feel that offended. He knows how to play, you know, the crowd in that way. Still, you know, the majority of Latinos are never going to vote for Trump.
I mean, of course, if you're Venezuelan and you've been brought up with Hugo Chavez, you've probably seen all this before.
Well, that's
I mean, John, looking at the vice presidential thing from the other side of the cab, does it make any difference to Hillary if she names Julian Castro, the Secretary of Housing, who's also a Texan, or Tom Perez, the Secretary of Labor, both of whom, in fairness, look like perfectly plausible candidates, their heritage notwithstanding? But does that kind of thing make a difference for her?
I think it might do. As you say, these are plausible candidates, and this might actually happen. She seems to be well-liked in the Latino communities already. I mean, partly the complaints about lack of contact we've just been discussing. Having a Latino vice presidential, having a running mate, might well give her another few percentage points amongst Latinos.
You will remember, John, that in the previous election, Bill Richardson was going to be the vice president. If not because of the scandal he got involved in, he would have been the first Latino descendant in the White House. It's very likely that they will make that move, notwithstanding your peculiar comparison between Chavez and Trump. They have nothing to do. Latinos tend to be more progressive in political issues. They do care about health, education, and so on. And in that sense, the Democratic Party looks like a better house for them than the Republicans.
I mean, Oscar, does the opening up of Cuba make any difference to anything at all in this context? Does it make Florida more of a banker for Hillary or Trump than it otherwise might have?
Actually, it does. I mean, there are two elements in Florida. On the one hand, the fact that the older Cuban generation, which tended to be more hardline, has now been superseded by a newer generation who does not care that much about the Castros, and they think that actually the opening is a good idea. In fact, again, if you talk to Floridans there, you see that the ground is changing.
And just a final thought from you, John. Is there a way that Trump can win more Latino votes? Should he take more pictures of himself eating tacos?
Eating tacos might help, showing that he's got some kind of empathy with the things that Latino voters care about. might help also, but I just don't see Trump being plausible on education or healthcare somehow, do you?
Not really.
He could try going to Venezuela like the Spanish guy, see what happens.
On that happy thought, Oscar Guardiola Rivera and John Everard, thank you very much for joining us at Midori House. That is all for today's show. It was produced by Daniel Giacopelli, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Faith Barker and Alice Tennant. Our studio manager was Toby Hammond. There's more music next at 1900. Rob Bound is in with The Culture Show, and there's more on the day's big stories on The Daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. But for now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.